This is Anne Holland over at Email Sherpa, and on this kind of holiday week, I would like to welcome George Bilbrey. I guess you're not on vacation this week, George?
That is correct. I am working.
Making sure that email is delivered. George is the Vice President and General Manager of Deliverability for ReturnPath. And just about a year ago, we had our big teleseminar clinic on how to get your email past filters, and George, of course, was our guest star for that clinic. And I wanted to get back in touch with you, George, because you gave us such really good information then, and find out, it's a year later, how have things changed? What do emailers need to know these days? And the first thing, of course, the big number everybody wants to know is, how has delivery changed? Last year, you told me that overall, in general, about 15 to 17% of permission mailers, perfectly good opt-in mail, was being stopped because it was a false positive, and it was being stopped by a filter thinking that it might be spam.
Right.
Has that changed?
Our most recent numbers would show that it's the same order of magnitude, but slightly higher. About approximately 20% of messages are not making it into the inbox. They're either being put in the bulk mail folder or junk mail folder, or simply being not delivered at all.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still a problem for folks who use email to stay in touch with their clients.
Now, is this including personal filters? What are all the different filters?
This number is around ISP environments. So it's based on the top 18 ISPs, based on kind of our client's definition of top 18 ISPs. So the large guys would be who you'd expect, AOL, Yahoo, MSN. Some of the smaller guys would include USA.net and Roadrunner and a fair number of the smaller broadband providers, for example.
So that's not including a corporate. If I'm going to the business-to-business marketplace and I'm maybe being caught on the IT department side by a filter they may have purchased, that's maybe not including that.
That is correct. Yes.
And that's not including the personal filter.
That is correct as well.
So it could be much higher.
Could potentially be much higher. I have seen some data that would indicate that filtering in the B2B environment does have a higher false positive rate. That's primarily based on the fact that blacklists, by and large, have very high false positive rates, and corporate environments are much more likely to use a blacklist. A survey that we did approximately 8 months ago now with Forrester would indicate about 30 or 35% of corporate system administrators use one or several blacklists to protect their inbox. Blacklists tend to have much higher false positive rates.
Now, what about the whole difference caused by the latest, the AOL 9.0 that came out? I guess it was about a year ago now, but really it didn't hit full throttle AOL usership until about January. We estimated that by January 2004, it was at about 50% of AOL users, and I'm assuming it's much higher now. And we were worried about all sorts of fancy filters they had added in for the user.
Right. There is a adaptive filter that exists for AOL 9.0, as well as adaptive filters that are in other email clients as well. But 9.0 is the one with the highest penetration. In our experience, the weight that's given to that in terms of as an email marketer, probably the focus needs to be first on the upfront filters that all customers. That all AOL subscribers will be facing. So first of all, are you getting to the gateway? Are they blocking you by IP address? And then once you get through there, there's a bunch of common content filters that AOL will run on any large volume bulk mail coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So that should be a primary concern. It's very hard for a marketer to determine consumer A versus consumer B what exactly their adaptive filter looks like. So my advice to a marketer is to worry about the common filters that occur across all AOL subscribers first and foremost.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the universe of the challenge response world, the mailbox, especially, I guess AOL just purchased Mailbox,
exactly,
the company,
right.
And I know that Earthlink is also rolling out a challenge response system for all of its users.
Right.
Where, and let me just define that for our readers, just for the newbies out there, that this is a situation in which you send a message to somebody who's using a challenge response, and you get pinged in response saying, I've put this filter up here, you know, to stop spam. And if you're a real human being, you must click through. And you know, I think usually you have to enter like a secret code on a thing to be able to have the rest of your email let in
right.
From then on. And it seems to be, I mean, it was sort of the very early adopters last year. You know, it was those the real techies, people who had been on the net for 10 or 15 years, you know, people like that. Now it seems to be going much more mainstream. What are you seeing in terms of challenge response filtering?
Well, yeah, as you indicated, it is more common than it used to be. There's AOL, who's recently purchased Mailbox, which is a challenge response vendor. And so the assumption is sometime in 2005 they will be implementing challenge response. Earthlink's had it for quite a while now, actually. It's been probably about a year now, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
Right now, if you take a look at the Earthlink experience, it's probably not going to be the case that 100% of all subscribers at those domains will have challenge response turned on. It's unlikely that by default challenge response will be turned on, mostly because it dramatically increases the bandwidth cost for the ISP.
It does. Oh, is it because it's pinging everybody back?
Exactly right. So
they're not going to turn it on by default then, yeah.
Right, and also, it can be considered potentially somewhat rude. So the experience at Earthlink is, I happen to have a chance to talk with some of their product management folks, I think it's 3 or 4 months ago now.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, they had indicated that the penetration was somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 20%. That was approximately 9 months after Earthlink had started. So even today, it's far from universal acceptance of challenge response. Having said that, 10 or 20% of Earthlink and AOL, and then there are a wide variety of standalone email filtering clients that use challenge response technology.
Mm-hmm.
Mail Frontier's Matador is an example of that. It is an issue. So what is a marketer to do? There are really two things that are required. First, getting in the user's address book is important. It's the way to avoid getting the challenge message sent out. So the second thing that a marketer is to do is to actually staff up or work to answer those challenge response messages in a timely manner. We found with Earthlink, just experimenting, that you do need to respond to those challenges in an extremely timely manner. If the client,
what do you mean by extremely timely manner? Is it like an hour or two or a day or two?
Ideally within 24 hours,
uh-huh.
12 hours would be better. The reason for that is if the user deletes the messages that are in the kind of holding pen, I believe in Earthlink it's called suspect mail folder, if they delete
that.
Oh, and
I bet they do just to clean out their box.
Then any response to a challenge doesn't work at that time. After that folder has been cleaned out. There is also a automatic cleaning that goes on after a certain number of days, but it's actually pretty lengthy. So the problem, the race is to answer the challenge before the end user cleans out that folder.
So not only do you have to work with an email vendor who either will automatically sort and forward challenge responses to your customer service department to handle them, or somebody who can handle them on their end, but you also have to make sure the darn things are handled extremely quickly.
Right, yes. Speed is of the essence.
But I'm assuming those particular email addresses, while it may only be 10 to 20% of your file,
those are probably
going to be pretty darn good addresses because people who took the trouble to protect them.
I think that's it, potentially. Or if you can get them to respond by saying, yes, I want this individual to, there is a permission loop in most of these challenge response systems where after you say, yes, I would like to be added to subscriber A's address book, they have to say, okay, that's fine. This person can be added to my address book. I want to receive mail from them. If someone does that, they're probably a pretty good prospect. You're probably talking to someone who's interested in hearing what you have to say. One thing you said earlier is 10 or 20% of your file. I don't think it will be 10 or 20% of your file. It'll likely be a much lower number. Typically, for example, let's say that the number is 10%, just for ease of math, of subscribers at ISPs that use Challenge Response, turn it on. That would be, you know, 10% of AOL, which is going to be typically be 2 or 3% of a total list, and 10% of Earthlink, which is going to be around 0.5%. So we're talking probably right now under 5%.
Depending on what kind of list you have. I mean, if you're
depending
BBC,
on the list,
you're going to be huge. Yeah, in AOL, but yeah.
It's going to be under 10% even for, you know, most of my clients that are heavy B2C. So it's not the vast preponderance of your list, but it's a large enough portion of your list to take note.
Okay. And it's a trend to take note of. It's a continuing trend to take note of, because if it's taking off here, you know, who knows which ISPs it may take off at next.
Right, right.
Now, of course, my next question is about all of this authentication. Everyone's been talking, I've been getting a lot of press releases and seeing a lot of news about the proposals for authentication. What is authentication really all about? Is it really going to happen? Is this really going to make a difference in delivery for the marketer?
Well, it will happen, and it will have an impact on you. Necessarily having to do with deliverability. So what authentication is at the highest level is basically a mechanism by which you can determine that the mail is coming from someone who they say it is. So, you know, if mail is coming from george@bilbrey.com, you can authenticate that indeed that mail is coming from the domain bilbrey.com. That's all authentication is. There are a variety of different techniques or standards, rather, that are being proposed. One is called SPF, which I've heard it called different things, but I believe it stands for Sender Policy Framework. Another is called Sender ID. Both of those stand, and so Sender ID is being championed primarily by Microsoft. Both of those standards are more or less similar techniques. They allow you to publish as the person who controls records about a domain, allow you to publish basically mail coming from this domain belongs, can be sent from certain IP addresses. And that's all those two standards are about. Mm-hmm. So any receiver can check that record, which was kept in what's called the DNS, or domain name service record, of that particular domain, can check a particular subrecord of that record and say, gosh, I just got mail from george@bilbrey.com, and it came from this IP address. Does that make sense based on the record that's published with bilbrey.com? And the answer to that can be yes, there's a match, or no, there's not a match, and then they can take action based on whatever policy they see fit.
Now, for organizations that don't have a centralized email system, for example, what if you've got a heck of a lot of sales reps on the road and maybe they're using their own email, or I don't know, maybe you have independent sales reps who officially look like they're you, but they're not. I can foresee problems there, but
yeah,
those organizations have to start centralizing anyway just to deal with canned spam.
There are a fair number of issues associated with that, and also with forwarding systems, that both of these proposals have different methods for handling. But but you're right that there are a lot of different ways that mail is sent. There's a lot of forwarding. Yahoo has told me that, you know, up to 20% of the mail they receive actually is a forwarded mail. So
and what do you mean by that?
So someone, for example, has an alumni account at their university, and they then forward that mail on to Yahoo. So although the initial mail came from wherever, came from Marketing Sherpa, for example, to Yahoo, it looks like it's coming from Tulane University or wherever the university
account. And then Yahoo's going to say, well, that's not Tulane's IP.
Well,
or that's not
actually
Marketing Sherpa's IP.
Potentially. And so it requires the forwarding service actually to make some changes to the header as they pass the mail along to meet Sender ID and SPF standards. So, you know, back to the initial question, is this going to actually affect deliverability? My not-so-simple answer is yes and no.
Okay.
Yes, if you publish your record poorly, it's possible that your mail may not get delivered. So I've seen examples for a few of our clients already that a few domains are not accepting mail because they have incorrectly specified an SPF or, well, in this case, SPF record.
Now, who publishes that record? Is that my IT department? What if I'm using
a
broadcast vendor?
Yeah, it should be.
So
if you're a marketer
them?
And you control your DNS for your domain, it should be your IT department. And whoever in the IT department who publishes that record should be doing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the other way it will affect you immediately, or not so immediately, but potentially in say October, November, December time frame,
mm-hmm.
is that Hotmail in particular, who will be using the sender ID standard, will be putting a bar in that says we couldn't authenticate this message using sender ID.
Oh God! And that's how easy is that to filter on?
Well, yeah, so, you know, at least visually filter, you open up the message immediately, you see, this looks a little fishy to Hotmail. This probably is fishy. I'm just going to go ahead and delete that. I think now, frankly, I think they're still figuring out exactly what their policy is. So is that bar only going to be there if there is a published record and they can't authenticate, or is that bar going to be there if there is no record published? I think they're still figuring out that policy, but there is a potential that that could be a problem for marketers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in terms of will it actually improve your delivery rate, I think it could have a marginal effect, a slightly positive effect in the near term.
Mm-hmm.
There are a variety of different machine learning filters that are used by these companies. It could be that's a factor that's thrown into these filters. It may help you out at the margin. However, there's nothing to prevent a spammer from registering a very large number of throwaway domains, publishing perfectly valid SPF and sender ID records, and sending spam from them. So
mm-hmm.
I don't think having a valid record is by itself evidence that you are a sender in good standing.
No, I guess what they're trying to say is we're going to stop the phishing. We're going to stop the scam artists.
Exactly.
Claiming that they're eBay, but they're not.
Right. They're stopping spoofing, and that's the primary purpose.
Right. But in the meantime, there's a lot of people who are using email broadcast firms, and those email broadcast firms are using from email addresses that are not always their client's domain. I mean, I know that for a fact. For example, right now, if you get an email newsletter from us, I think it says marketingsherpa.tmoo1.com. It's not marketingsherpa.com.
Right. So that email provider will have to, the domain is actually, .tm0.com, right? So that person will have to publish an SPF and sender ID record
just
for you, right, for that
Which
subdomain.
Means that an email broadcast firm can't use the same you can't use the same domain for two different clients, which a lot of them are. They're just putting dot whatever domain. So it's client name dot vendor domain dot com. I've seen that a lot.
Well, actually, they should be publishing a separate record for each of those subdomains. So they control the domain. For each of the subdomains, they should be publishing a record that says this
mm-hmm.
subdomain can be mailed from this particular IP address. So in those cases, it's actually a lot easier for the email service provider, the vendor,
mm-hmm.
because they control the DNS for that particular domain.
And they can be sure it's well done.
And they can make sure it's well done. They're in the business of sending mail, so it's more likely to be done there in a centralized environment. However, they're still, it's still a little bit of art, a little bit of science, and you should go ahead and test to validate those particular records once they are published to make sure it works for your mailings.
How do you do that?
Well, there are a variety of checkers that are available online to validate. ReturnBath will be in the process of publishing one to our clients in the near future. There's some stuff that's available at a variety of different sites. The easiest one to get to is an SPF validator, which is at spf.pobox.com. There's a validator in there. There are a variety of others.
So why not? So you should go in there and check out whether or not your stuff is validated yet.
Right. So you basically put in the from domain and the
mm-hmm.
or the domain and the IP address and hit go, and it'll go pull the record for that domain and tell you whether or not it's valid.
That's great. Now, I have to ask, what the heck is going on with Gmail? Is there any data in yet on Gmail and filters and what they're doing with mail, how it's getting through to them, anything yet? I mean, I know the numbers of Gmail users are still pretty microscopic compared to all the big ISPs.
Right. I mean, we haven't explored that in as much detail as we could. There are a few things I can tell you, but mm-hmm. frankly, it's not of great interest to my clients right now because the numbers are infinitesimal. You know, it's still less than 0.1% of a typical B2C list. I would thoroughly expect that to grow over time, but it's not the number one problem facing most of our clients.
Mm-hmm.
The major problem, as I see it, isn't so much filtering, which based on some very cursory analysis on our end, does appear to have a somewhat sizable false positive rate. But what is particularly interesting at this point, and this is based on some just looking at a couple of Gmail accounts about 2 months ago, it may have changed since then, mm-hmm. is that
because it's still in quote-unquote beta.
Yeah, images don't show by default there.
Right.
And there's no equivalent of adding folks to the address book to make that go away. You basically have to choose on every message
mm-hmm.
to make it show. Now, that may have changed since I looked at it last, but I find that to be a major driver of client performance.
Mm-hmm.
If you can get the images to show by default, you're going to do a lot better. And that's not doable in Gmail.
No, it's totally not yet that I know of. And I know I checked it just on Friday. So now let's talk the OPA law. Now, when I was looking over California's online marketing law that just came into effect, it was the Online Privacy Protection Act.
Right.
It kicked off July 1st, so it's about 2 months old now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very short, it's a very brief thing to read. And when we publish this interview, I'll also publish a little link to it so people can go look at it. It's like a page. It's very,
yeah.
very short,
yeah.
Unlike most laws. It talks about the fact that you have to have a very prominent and visible link to your privacy policy. It doesn't specifically say a lot about email, though. In fact, what it says is if you offer a quote-unquote online service,
right.
then you have to make the email the privacy policy link very bold and very big and very obvious.
Right.
But I suspect looking at it that because they didn't use the word website, they used the word online service, that email could be definitely read into that. And if that is the case, it also means that you need to have, that I'm assuming that would mean in your art, you would have to put your privacy policy link a lot, yeah, a bigger, bolder, larger. I mean, we all kind of, everything, most of us kind of stick it in a little tiny thing down at the bottom of the email. It's part of the copyright line, thing. If that. But if this is coming into effect and this, they really do mean email by online service, this is, and it's got to be commercial. So if it's a commercial email, that's got to be big.
Yeah, so we are recommending to our clients they do, at a minimum, include a link to their privacy policy as prominently as is prudent on their outbound emails.
Mm-hmm.
You're right that the interpretation of the law, it's a new law, and there isn't a lot of case law around that. There haven't been a lot of rulings, so it's uncertain exactly what is meant by that law at that point, I would say. So our recommendation is to basically slap links to that privacy policy where it makes sense. So that would be in the email, but it would also be on just about every web page, typically,
mm-hmm.
as part of the sort of standard template, particularly wherever you're gathering email addresses and other sorts of information, you most definitely should have a very prominent link there.
The thing that really shocks me, and because we're constantly doing case studies about marketing campaigns, and so I'm looking at, I probably look at 100 landing pages a week, for, here, click through here and register, to get the newsletter, to sign up for the sweeps, for whatever. And I would say 9 times out of 10, even for large brand name companies, people you think would know better, it'll just have the word, email, and it'll have a little box. And if there's any mention of a privacy policy, it's tiny, tiny print way at the bottom of the page that you have to scroll to look for.
Right.
That just seems absurd to me that it isn't knee-jerk to marketers that you would stick a little note next to that box just saying, we'll never sell your name, or your name is safe, or just anything. Just,
yeah.
It's a reassuring thing to get that box filled out.
I think it would be an interesting experiment to see if by putting a prominent link to a privacy policy, what that does to subscription rates. My hypothesis, I think, would be that if you basically are putting a link there, it actually would if anything, raise subscription rates because you're showing, gosh, I'm a good guy. You know, I have a privacy policy. I'm willing to show you where it is and tell you exactly what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not aware of any studies that have been done like that. But
I believe we have several, although usually it's one of several elements the marketer changed. And, you know, if they've done, you know, maybe they tweaked the headline or maybe they did several things. But I know in all the cases that we have done case studies showing that if you did have that wording there, it did seem to make a difference. I don't know if we've got an A-B split on it, though.
So if it doesn't, you know, if it doesn't hurt and the law is a little bit vague as to the standard of what is prominent, you know, it seems like the best thing to do is where you are collecting that email address, put the link there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at the very least, why not? I think it's sort of like a money back guarantee language, or a, you know, biz rate seal of approval, or whatever.
Right.
You know, it's the sort of thing that makes people feel safe. So why wouldn't you put it near there? So the OPA law, basically, we're just going to wait for lawsuits. In the meantime, why not just stick your privacy policy link in your HTML template and in your text only template, and just make sure it's there.
Right.
Now let's talk about personal whitelisting.
Okay.
Everyone, you know, has become sort of aware that a lot of consumers are using personal whitelists in the business environment and also at home, and that now usually I'll see marketers when you sign up for email, the next page will say, and please add us to, you know, the whitelist. And often, and I actually collect people's welcome messages because I'm crazy that way. And I've got all the welcome messages. And I've noticed over the past year that I've seen a lot more people automatically adding a little bit into their welcome message, you know, that very first email that goes out saying, and please remember to add us to your whitelist. But aside from those two places, that page right after someone subscribes and that welcome message, where are other places where you can get the word out about personal whitelists and please add us? Have you seen any creative ways to get that word out?
I mean, the other place you see all over the place is a link, usually in mice type, at the top of particularly HTML messages. You know, if you can't see this message, click here. As typically for folks that aren't in the whitelist, at personal whitelist at say AOL and other places where that's going to cause your images not to show.
Oh.
Or you know, I've also seen the similar sorts of stuff repeated at the bottom of messages. Another place that we would recommend is in the preference center or equivalent pages where you can change your email address, subscribe, unsubscribe, having some links and instructions there, particularly if someone's changing their address to a new ISP, that's a particularly good place to have it.
Mm.
One thing that we believe actually increases the likelihood that someone is going to add you to their personal whitelist, basically add you to their address book is what we're saying, is to provide detailed instructions on how to do that. So having, for someone who's an AOL user, for example, having some step-by-step instructions, ideally with some screenshots that would indicate here's exactly how one does that, would be extremely useful. We don't have any hard data on that, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
We have noted that clients that push this a lot harder
mm-hmm.
Appear to have higher open rates than they did before they started doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, in terms of hard empirical evidence, we don't really have anything on that.
Mm-hmm. Which clients, if I was going to go sign up for one of your clients who had really great step-by-step instructions, who would you recommend I go sign up
Well,
for?
We actually have some available at, I believe, at www.returnpath.biz, some instructions that are kind of free for anyone to pull down that they can incorporate on their website. So that's the place I would point them.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have to get back to you on, you know, some really good stuff. I need to clear that with my client first.
Oh, sure. I'd love that. You know, anytime a client's doing something great, I want to know about it so I can
okay.
talk about it. In particular, you know, I've heard that MSN users are, along with AOL users, the most likely to be kind of internet newbies or less technically inclined, less
sure.
interested in fiddling with gadgets, more likely to be female, and hey, I'm a little busy right now. I don't want to horse around with this stuff. So maybe those are the most critical ones to get those really good instructions out to.
Yep. I think that it's you do whatever you can to make it as easy as possible for that person. One other thing, there are some tricks you can try. A handful of clients have been sending out VCF attachments, so basically address
Sorry,
card
VCS?
attachments
Oh,
for Outlook and Outlook Express. I think it's an interesting idea. I'm not entirely sure it'll work, only because it's very possible to have viruses inside of VCS attachments,
Yeah.
and so I think most people will not click on anything. Other folks, however, this is an AOL specific issue, is that it turns out that if you can get someone to reply to a message that so basically you send a message and they reply to it, mail coming from that particular from address in the future more or less is whitelisted. So
Oh.
specifically around the not around deliverability, but in terms of graphics and images showing, they will show by default. So that's a trick that a few of our clients are playing with in different ways.
So in other words, give them a reason to hit that reply button instead of clicking on a link or something.
Exactly.
Just
And you can have them click on a link and have it be a mail to tag or something. I think I'm not sure if that works in AOL 9.0, but I believe it does. So, but easiest thing to have them do is actually just reply to the message.
And that's something some people would be hesitant to do because you don't want your customer service dealing with a lot of inbound mail. But if you can come up with something easy,
Right.
why not? You know, vote now, yes or no, just hit reply, something like
Right.
that. Yeah, that's a great idea. Now, do you have any advice on the business-to-business end? About 65% of our readers are business-to-business, and they are really struggling with getting through corporate filters.
Sure.
To the point where some of them are actually going out to their customers and saying, "Give me a home email address. I don't want to deal with these corporate guys because they have these dumb filters that are content-based and or based on blacklists. It's just
Right.
the worst filtering thing." Is there anything that B2B mailers should be doing or can be doing?
Sure. I think that the first thing to do is to test the heck out of your messages before you send them out.
Just for content filters.
For content filters. So there are services, we provide one, but there are others that allow you to pre-test a message by sending it across a battery of filters set at different kind of degrees of stringency at which the filter is set. So, typically these have a very large B2B component. So we actually based ours on the same survey that we did with Forrester of system administrators. We based the filters that we used on that particular study. So, so it turns out that a list of somewhere in the neighborhood of about 10 filter types should represent somewhere in the neighborhood of about 70% of the filtering environments out there. So that's the good news, is that with only looking at a handful of filters, you can get pretty broad coverage. The bad news is after that first 10, it really tails off, and it's much more fragmented at that point. So it's harder to get as good coverage with a few filters at that point. The second thing that folks should be doing is looking at their log files, which is a log file very simply is a copy of the conversation between the your sending mail server and the receiving mail servers. And you can write routines that scan for the response codes coming back that would say, 550, 571, access denied, I'm not taking mail from you, you're listed on the following blacklist, or whatever the code is. There are a variety of standard kind of words and codes that you can expect across a very broad spectrum of receivers. And if you scan for that, you can get a very quick feel for who's blocking you and who's not blocking you. So the question is, what do you do at that point in time? Kind of our rule of thumb is you should have always at all times a list of which domains are important, which ones aren't important, which ones make up a large portion of your list, and which ones don't.
So if perhaps you're pitching a new client on $1 million account, you should know all their email domains. They probably only have one, but they may have a couple.
Right.
And you should make sure that, you're checking against those so that email's getting through.
Exactly right. Or if it turns out one domain is extremely prominent on your list, that's something that's important. So in the
Right.
cases where it's an important list, you probably need a little bit of human interaction. You need to have someone call or email.
Who do you call over there? Say it's a
Well,
giant
the easiest thing
company,
to do is email. There's always role accounts, typically postmaster at. Sometimes I would copy abuse at, see if there's a security at address. All the standard role accounts typically are manned by someone. It may take them a while to get around to you. But that, the
So
other
you would be perhaps you'd send out an email to abuse and postmaster and security at and just say, hey, what would you say? We're trying to get email through to your company and your executive.
Yeah, we have 30 subscribers. This is
and we can prove that they signed up for it.
Right. You appear to be blocking us. You know, like, I'd love to talk to you about it. Here's my phone number. Here's my
cell
phone.
Here's my direct line.
Here's my email address.
Here's my home address. Here's my dog's
exactly.
picture. Yeah. Okay.
So, that's the primary thing. Another thing you can do is, of course, enlist your subscribers to help out. They may actually know who the IT guy is. If you're getting intermittently blocked, that's something that you
that's
can
content.
Do. If you have been so wise as to collect an alternative address for those same users, it's hard to get them to actually fill that out, but if you make it optional, you might get a few of them.
Mm-hmm.
You can contact them at their Yahoo account or their home account,
mm-hmm.
Whatever it happens to be, and say, hey, listen, looks like we're being blocked. Just thought let you know if you want to talk to your IT group, that would be fine with us.
Mm-hmm. We even had situations where somebody would pick up the phone and just
right.
say, hey,
sure, right.
Ask for the IT department and just get it. Just it's worth it. Maybe once a month to sit down for your critical ones and get through. And so this is seeming to help. You said there were 10 top filters. I'm
right.
only aware of course, the most famous ones. Can you name a few of the other ones?
Yeah, let's name the companies because there are usually a variety of different filters under each
right,
of the companies.
Right, they have all different products.
But, so the big guys, according to our study, would include Symantec, would include Computer Associates, so that's basically Norton and McAfee.
Mm-hmm.
And variety of different, and that's typically more apparently in smaller kind of medium-sized businesses where they either have a server-side application or they actually have it running on the desktop.
Mm-hmm.
There are other classes of filters that are also pretty common, which would include stuff like I'll call them in the network or in the cloud filters, like Postini and MXLogic. Postini being much more common, and sort of gateway. Appliances. A good example of that would be Tumbleweed or Barracuda would be very common applications there. So there's a wide variety of them. The big guys, actually, though, are kind of names you would know, and they're more common among small and medium enterprises. But it would include, like I said, McAfee, Norton, and actually a company you should look out for. You may have heard of them called Microsoft. Is starting to publish in Exchange a built-in filter, which is similar, is based on similar technology that's in the current Outlook 2003 spam filter. So it's called the IMF, which I think stands for Intelligent Message Filter, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
That is, if not out, will be out relatively soon. So that's something that your reader should look out for.
Golly, so it's quite a bit of stuff that you have to really. Look out for in the B2B end.
B2B is a much more complex environment than is B2C at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What I often find is interesting is that the B2B mailer will say, oh, but I have such a small list, because they generally do it maybe extremely targeted, the absolute perfect 4,000 people in the world for this, $2 million piece of enterprise software. And they say, oh, geez, so why don't I just use a real, I don't need to spend a lot of money on email delivery. And I'm always like, actually, you do, because getting it through is going to be really hard.
It can be, and I think it's because you're.
You it's know, not about the size of the list anymore.
It's about content. It's about
mm-hmm.
it's about what blacklist they happen to be subscribing to at the moment. It's about a whole lot of things. So, my belief, though I don't have hard data on this, is the false positive rates in corporations are higher than they are at ISPs and. It kind of depends on how they have stuff set up, but a lot of it's at the whim of the system administrator in the IT department. So it's possible that a lot of mail isn't getting delivered.
Yeah, what's interesting is when I see a lot of these filters and other systems reviewed, I'll often see the reviews in various technology publications that the system administrators and CIOs and other executives would read. For example, Forbes even. They'll have these reviews about how well does it work, and they'll never mention false positive once. It won't even come up in the article. It won't even come up in the review, about, oh, do you have to worry that it might
be. They look at false positives and they publish it, but,
not an
one,
issue.
One man's spam is another man's ham.
Right.
What is a false positive? It's hard to say.
Right.
with email. You know, is it something that someone said, "Hey, I don't want this," even though they signed up for, or is it actually something they never signed up for? I think that a lot of filtering companies, when making that kind of determination, use the former definition, not the latter.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've recently heard that open rates, which have always been kind of a fuzzy number, because you know, there's a lot of opens that may not actually be opens. You know,
sure, right, or it might be counted twice or whatever. Right, a lot of issues.
Yeah, but there's a lot of open rates that may opens that may not even be being counted now because it's not reporting back properly because their filters going back and forth between the open rate reporting. So somebody may have opened it, but you don't know that.
Right.
Is that
there.
True?
There are certain not so much in the ISP world, but in the corporate world, there are sort of web beacon traps where there are ways to kind of fool with that request while still serving images. So,
are a lot of people using them?
I'm not aware of it. I've actually only seen, heard mention of it a few times. So
mm-hmm.
I think the real problem, you know, why are open rates down for some of my clients is because as AOL 9.0 got into heavier rotation, as well as Microsoft MSN, MSN's clients and Hotmail changed and you know, et cetera, graphics were showing less and less by default, and open rates, which had you know been probably maybe a little artificially high, because anytime you previewed something, for example,
yeah, they've always been artificially high. Yeah,
you know, that's no longer the case, so that's caused open rates to fall. But I'm not aware of a lot of that sort of application being in common use at this point.
So because the graphics aren't showing, the open rate, obviously the open reporting, which counts on it being an HTML, isn't working, which means that you're not getting, even though you may be getting an open, it's not reporting as an open, even though you think that the person is an HTML reader. Am I paraphrasing that correctly?
Right. So the way that open rates typically work is that each message, HTML message that's sent out, is calling a clear one-by-one graphic image,
mm-hmm.
a pixel, from your server. That name of that image actually is unique to typically each mailing and each receiver, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So each subscriber. And so if you know that particular pixel was called, you know that you know Fred opened up his email. So if the ISPs are blocking pulling of images by default, that pixel is not being pulled, so it looks like Fred never opened your message. He may have actually opened the message, but chose not to view images in that particular message.
Mm-hmm.
So that causes some measurement problems. Mm-hmm. But there always have been problems with open rates. Because
yeah.
if you, for example, were using Outlook and were previewing, you had the preview pane on, and you were just sort of going through your list of messages, that would actually cause that pixel to fire off, even though the person really wasn't actually looking at the message. So. Either, you know, there have been problems both ways, showing too many opens and too few opens.
So if people are now saying, oh my golly, over the past year my open rate's gotten a lot worse, in a way you don't absolutely know that. And
yeah,
when you do look at open rates, maybe what you should be looking at is week over week or send over send and not long-term trends.
Right. Or just look at the bottom line, which is, are people actually responding to your offers?
Yeah. Well, okay. That would be great if too many people just can't even measure that, which is very frustrating, but
right.
maybe someday. With so many images being turned off, how does that affect clickable links?
Well, yeah, that is some clients. I believe AOL 9.0, for example, will make links kind of by default not clickable. I know certainly Outlook 2003, it requires, instead of just one click, you know, you have to actually hold the control key and click the link.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that's much work for some people.
What?
That's too much work for a lot of people.
Yeah, it does make it slightly more onerous. So at the margin, I'm guessing that click-through rates by necessity have to fall because you're making people jump through more hoops to be able to click on links.
Hmm. Well, all right. Great. When it comes to ISP relations, and of course everyone's calling the ISPs or hoping to have a good relationship with the ISPs because they all want to, you know, be sure that if something is being filtered, they can pick up the phone and call so-and-so over at
sure.
AOL or Earthlink and have the guy answer and have the guy go, oh, okay, and let their mail through. you know, we did our buyer's guide to email vendors we published that, I guess, in May. And at that time, we had, I guess it was 71 services that we had reviewed that we thought were had enough employees and were large enough to be to match our readers' needs, in particular in terms of customer service.
Okay.
That's 71 people already who are trying to reach the ISPs and have that relationship. And then when you add in all the people who still think it's intelligent to send mail from in-house, that's a heck of a lot more people. Who's really getting through to the ISP folks? And, you know, should you really, is it more and more needful to go with a kind of a name brand email broadcast firm just because you know they can pick up the phone and call the guy at AOL and be listened to?
Well, I do think that it helps to have someone who's, when they're on the phone, can talk about more than one client. It's more efficient for the ISPs, and they kind of like it that way.
Yeah.
In addition, someone that you've developed a working relationship, if you're mailing in-house and you have a problem very occasionally, you're not going to have the kind of working relationship with the folks at the different ISPs that someone who's on the phone with them every week or every month at a minimum. So, you know, I think that there is some advantage to having an intermediary there. You know, just this is partially a marketing plug, but if you're pushing your own mail, but you don't have to go to an email service provider, that sort of vendor, to get those sorts of services. There are a variety of folks, including ourselves, that offer those sorts of services. So, you know, we have a staff of folks all day who are on the phone or via email with ISPs. We go out and see them in person all the time. Same thing with the guys at the larger email service providers. You know, they go on their ISP roadshows as well to meet these folks face-to-face. So, you know, you can still get that sort of service and continue to mail in-house.
That's good to know. So what is coming up next? There's one more phase of CAN-SPAM that we have to go through, the primary purpose clause. What's going on with that? They've just opened for comments a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I think you know, this is not my primary area of expertise, but yes, my understanding is that the, you know, sort of the definition of what is primary purpose is open for comment. I believe
that's
going
to be critical because everyone's been wondering if email newsletters as opposed to sales alerts and promos are affected, and I think the official line we've been saying is we think you're safe if it's a newsletter as long as it's not too promotional in nature.
Right. So, yeah, the proposed rules, as I remember them and could interpret them, was basically by space and by where the different messages are positioned in the message, so basically a top being more important than, say, on the side or on the bottom. If the focus of the message is preponderantly on a non-commercial, a non-sales related thing, then the primary purpose is not commercial. On the other hand, if you've got a big banner right at the top and then under that a text ad that's all about, you know, an offer, and then down at the bottom somewhere you've got squeezed in a little article, It's unlikely that you know, that message could be anything other than commercial in nature. So I think, like most things, there's a set of rules out there that are a little bit clearer than they used to be. They're not set yet, but they're a little bit what's proposed a little bit clearer than it used to be. But until there has actually been, this is actually extremely vague. What is the primary purpose of a message, even with those rules, is still a lot of interpretation. So really the question is, how does the FTC interpret this stuff and lawsuits down the road?
Yeah, and we all have to wait for that.
Right.
So, you know, about a year ago, we all hoped that by now we could say, oh, you know, the industry's gotten together, the filters have gotten together with the ISPs, have gotten together with the major mailers, and we're much more on board, and we're stopping spam, and we're stopping false positives, and we're all happy, happy, happy. It seems like, in a way, it's just gotten harder to be a mailer. It just continues to get harder to be a mailer. What's your take on the future? If I call you a year from now, what do you think?
I think a year from now, what we'll see is authentication will be more widely applied. And then we'll start to see the emergence of different sorts of stateless and reputation service along the lines of today's bonded sender program. But I know for a fact there are a lot of other folks that are out there in the market now doing similar sorts of stuff. Goodmail.
Oh, there's a heck of a lot of startups over there. Yeah.
Yeah. Goodmail, for example, a lot of others. So, you know, what I hope we'll see a year from now is services like that will start to take a lot of the hassle out of it. At least you only have to deal with one guy or maybe a couple of guys to solve a majority of your delivery issues rather than having to deal with every ISP where you've got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I hope to see. I think that it's actually relatively complex to gain the trust of an ISP to say, yeah, you know, if this guy's got my mark on it, you can definitely let him in the inbox. It's fine. Don't worry about it. It's a large step of faith for the ISP to take. So to get rapid adoption across, say, two or three reputation services and Safelist services is going to be, you know, it might be slower than a year from now. I don't know at this point. I hope it's the case because it's certainly a very manual and inefficient process at this point to deal with those sorts of problems.
Mm-hmm. How much cost, though, will it be for the mailer on the other end?
Depends on what the solution is. You know, the good mail solution, I think, can be, you know, could be potentially costly. You know, it's going to be, I don't know for sure. I don't have any signed information, but a minimum of 0.1 cents per mail and probably more. So, you know, I think that, and that's just stuff
expensive.
I've heard.
I mean, it sounds cheap, but when you add up how much people mail.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's potentially a decent cost. You know, the bond sender program is not free, though, relatively inexpensive at this point in time. You know, it depends on the size of your list and what you're doing, but it can be, could be costly. It could be cost effective depending on where you're having problems and what your, you know, kind of what your economics are.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm hoping that as things go on, you just have to sign up with a reputation service.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you're, or Safelist, as long as your performance is good, you will continue to get delivered, and the feedback will be extremely clear. You know, if you're not getting delivered, why that is versus the kind of reading of the different augers that you have to do
mm-hmm.
today. So
yeah, then you just have to deal with the delete key, and that's the next challenge.
Yeah, right. So that's, you know, that's what I hope we see. The future is always vague, but that seems to be the direction that things are headed in now.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time today, George. We will be publishing a summary of this online along with a link to this complete interview. In the summary, I'll put some of the URLs that we mentioned, the OPA law, the some of the links that you mentioned for filters and information so that people can go and look at them right away.
Great. Well, appreciate the chance, and good speaking with you again.
You too. Have a great Labor Day.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.